Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News. And now in depth on a housing market that went from bubble to bust to what looks like boom again. If you're trying to buy a house in the Twin Cities right now, you're in the midst of a market that probably feels pretty frustrating. In March, the number of homes that were available to buy was lower than it had been in 14 years. And when inventory is low, prices go up. And that's a problem if you're trying to buy your first or second house. It also means that more people rent, so rents are rising and affordable rental housing is hard to find. Today, a conversation about what it means to be a buyer, seller, or renter in this housing market. And as our guests join us, it'd be really valuable to hear from you. Are you running up against multiple offers and rising prices as you try to buy a house, especially if it's your first house? Tell me about that. And if you're renting, are you struggling to find a place that you can afford? So out there in this market, trying to sell, maybe trying to buy your first house, or renting. Tell me about the experience of it. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at CarrieMPR. Our guest, Elena McCargo, is co-director of Housing Finance Policy Center at the Urban Institute, and she's with us from D.C. And Elena, welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you, Carrie. Good to be with you.
Susan Wachter is the Wharton Professor of Real Estate and Finance and co-director of the Penn Institute of Urban Research. And Susan, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you, Carrie.
Susan, is what's happening in the Twin Cities, this very low inventory, thriving demand, I mean, is that indicative of what's happening in a lot of larger housing markets?
This is ubiquitous across cities in the United States today. How this differs from the past is we've seen booms and bubbles and on the coast, but this is across the country. And clearly, where you are, you're partaking in this general trend.
And is the reason essentially what I've suggested in that people that the inventory is low? People just are not putting as many houses up for sale? Why would that be?
Yes, the inventory low is the reason, is the proximate cause, but it's not the underlying cause. The underlying cause is it's difficult to build, which means that costs, construction, new housing costs are going up. And also, it's difficult, particularly for first-time owners, to get into the market. So first-time owners aren't buying, and that means that starter homes are not selling, and that means that those who would like to move up, sell their home and move up, can't sell to the millennials. The millennials can't buy because credit is very tight.
Ah.
So the underlying problems are not the inventory. That's a symptom.
Okay.
Tight credit and low housing supply.
Elena, let me get to the tight credit part of that. Why is that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And as Susan noted, we are definitely in a precarious situation across the country, seeing really a growing mismatch between housing availability and housing needs, and extreme pressure on both ownership and home rentals. The issues with tight credit are numerous. But you know, since the housing crisis, there has just been extreme pressure in terms of regulatory demands on lending, and there's also been issues in terms of credit quality. And right now, if you look at housing, you know, credit scores are the most pristine we've seen in decades in terms of the loans that are being made.
Wow.
In this environment. And it's a really, and home prices are higher and interest rates are lower. The loans are of just pristine quality. And that, you know, that is just a signal that lenders are, you know, holding back in terms of even making loans available and credit available to folks that need it.
Let me follow on that, Elena, because that's interesting. So when you see, I mean, this is something that lenders want, pristine credit. But what that tells you is a lot of people that don't have pristine credit, but might be able to afford to make a mortgage payment, they are not being able to get the loans that they need. Yes?
That's right. And so, you know, lenders have pulled back significantly since the foreclosure crisis. That's a serious – access to credit is just a serious barrier to entry, as is the ability to save and afford a down payment. So, you know, there are a lot of, you know, down payment products are very popular right now, but on average, people are, you know, even in the first-time home buyer ranks, the characteristics, credit characteristics of a first-time home buyer, and your average first-time home buyer's loan is $226,000.
Wow.
Nationally.
Yeah.
For a conventional loan with an average credit score of 740. An average loan for an FHA is over $200,000 with a 679 credit score. So the price, you know, even for first-time home buyers, is just much higher on average. And many of these loans have higher loan-to-value ratios, meaning that people are taking out larger loans.
Mm-hmm.
With lower down payments. And so this is just, you know, and the factors around those and the fear that lenders have of defaults from what we went through in the crisis has really constricted what's happening on the lending side.
Susan, quick question here before we go to some calls. I was on Zillow over the weekend, and I saw that in the Twin Cities, the median housing price is $254,900.
Mm-hmm.
And they're reporting that home values here have gone up 7.4% over a year ago. They're calling this housing market warm. What is the impact of having housing values rising at that, you know, 7% and more on the rest of what's happening with the market and the access that people have to it?
Well, housing prices are rising at 7%. Rents also are rising at 5% plus across the nation and in your area. And wages are not. Salaries are not. So this puts particularly young households who don't own, who may still be living at home.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we have more young people living at home than any time in our history as a percentage of the population. It puts them in a bind because now they have jobs. Jobs market has come back, but salaries and wages are not growing, and they're certainly not growing to the extent that housing prices and rents are increasing.
Okay. Call here from Loewy in Minneapolis. Loewy, are you renting or are you looking to buy?
Hi, I am renting, and I consider buying, but I'm not actually looking. I'm one of those who has pristine credit. I have a down payment, and I would need a co-signer for a loan. Mm-hmm. I'm building my business, and so I'm renting, and right now I feel like my housing is affordable, and I live in a neighborhood where I can walk. I don't have a car, you know, keeping a very simple lifestyle so that I can build my business and my practice. And I see some new constructions going up that are inflating the rental right in this neighborhood, and people move out of the building, and all of a sudden for the next renter, the price goes up,
right?
20%. And it's kind of concerning, you know, what's the future going to look like. And so I was talking with a neighbor. We were just talking about how we need rent control in Minneapolis. We need to start talking about that with government.
This is interesting, Loewy. Elena, to you on this, that Minneapolis-St. Paul has a particular low inventory of rental housing. It's something that our Met Council has been talking about for a while. Is that the case in a lot of other cities, and what does that mean for people? I guess it sounded like our caller was from, you know, in her 30s and would be interested in buying a house, but she may be forced to do that sooner than she'd like because of rising rents.
Yes, well, we are seeing, and this is something that's happening nationally, and you're seeing, you know, households are forming faster than housing is being built. There's a lack of affordable housing supply that, you know, it kind of in the system, and there's a lot of work being done to try to remedy that. But that is putting significant pressure on rents. And so what what Loewy is experiencing is absolutely something that is happening in a lot of places where the pressure because of home price and home price rising and supply constraints that is being put on renters is increasingly problematic. It's, you know, renters are increasingly seeing housing cost burdens across the nation where people are paying more than 50% of their income.
Wow.
You know, on their rent, which is completely, you know, unsustainable. And so that's a significant problem. There is a lag in new construction at the lower price price points, and where, you know, there is a affordable housing stock, there are issues with the conditions of the stock and a lack of affordability for, you know, to get renovations done. And so there's a whole host of issues there, really in the construction zone, and that needs to be addressed to really help take the pressure off rents.
Elena McCargo is with us. If you've just tuned in, she's co-director of the Housing Finance Policy Center at the Urban Institute. And Susan Wachter is with us from the Wharton School, where she's co-director of the Penn Institute of Urban Research. We've asked them to join us this morning to talk about what's happening with renting and housing values and access to buying a home and what's happening with credit and lending, because we've gone kind of from, you remember the bubble, we went to the bust. This is feeling kind of like a boom again, which I haven't directly asked our guests, and I should. But if you're in a situation where you're running up against some multiple offers, you're trying to buy your first or second house, tell me about what that means for the decisions that you're making. And then if you're renting, are you struggling to find a place that is affordable? 800-242-2828-651-227-6000 on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Susan, are we headed for bubble land? Are you concerned about that or no?
I'm not concerned about bubble land right now. The prices are reflecting fundamentals. The fundamentals are reflecting lack of supply and demand on the high end, not demand on the low end. So we're seeing both the prices that we're seeing are reflecting where people can buy, which is high-end buyers. And it's also reflecting costs increasing. That's on the housing side. So it's not a bubble. A bubble is when a bust is coming around the corner. A bust is, we don't know when, it's inevitable. That's what a bubble is. We don't see an end to these prices. These prices are reflecting fundamentals, lack of supply.
And Elena, given what you said about what's happening with lenders and the regulatory framework that they're working under now, that was a factor in the last bubble, right? Too many people getting loans that they couldn't afford and the banks being highly irresponsible around that. Do we have the right measures in place to ensure that that doesn't happen again?
Yeah, I mean, I think the situation now is just vastly different than what we were seeing back then. And, you know, home prices, as I mentioned, they've been going up across the country. Credit's been tight. I don't think we're in a bubble nationally. I agree with Susan on that. There are some areas of the country that are seeing home prices at peak levels. In Minnesota, home prices peaked in 2006 and then steadily declined until 2012 and then have started to tick back up since. Prices have not yet climbed back to where they were in 2006, but at the current pace, you know, we'd be somewhere back near peak levels, you know, just in Minnesota sometime next year.
Wow.
The difference this time, though, is compared to 2006 is that there is not a lot of lending going on running up to the 2008 period. A lot of people were buying homes at top prices, higher interest rates. Then, you know, the bubble burst and prices declined quickly, leaving a lot of people who borrowed in a negative equity or stressful situation. We're just not seeing that huge run-up in lending happening because of the tight credit we talked about earlier.
Right.
And with, you know, it's just not happening in concert with this elevation of home prices. So the fundamentals are playing out. And many, you know, we just wouldn't compare the home price growth of today with kind of the bubble bust that's in everybody's recent memory.
Adam says on Twitter, four offers before one was accepted, 6 to 10,000 above asking, had to agree to no seller's disclosures for the property that I bought. And Dale is tweeting for the first time. He says, I'm a landlord, own a house on the west side of St. Paul, four bedroom for $1,250. Dale, that sounds like a pretty good deal. Same renter for 5 years. To the phones here to Kay in St. Paul. Hi, Kay. What's your experience with this? Hi.
I just wanted to just add a point that I just closed on a house and in the process of buying the one property that we were looking at bidding on actually went $55,000 over the asking price.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, we were sort of one of the higher bids, but they asked us to remove all of our, because I think when you buy a house, people know that the house can be contingent on whether you, that it appraises for the value or that you, they asked us to remove that so that, and it was that they knew that it wasn't worth that, and yet there were people who were bidding way above what the house was worth. And I was concerned about the bubble, thinking, well, if I buy this property at this price, I'm never going to recoup it. And so I just wonder how many first-time homeowners know, like, what they're getting themselves into when they bid over what it's worth.
Good.
The other thing I did want to just add quick, that I did buy my first house here at the height of the market, May of 2006.
Uh-huh.
We actually just sold our house for $20,000 more than we paid for at the height of the market. So I would just maybe dispute your guest just said about not being at the levels that we were in 2006, because I sold mine for more than $20,000 more. I bought it in 2006.
Elena, does it make you nervous to hear Kay talking about the deals that buyers are now willing to cut, you know, with these disclosures and stuff?
It does. It does. Those types of, and that is the environment that we're in, particularly in certain price points where things are just ultra competitive, and we're seeing that also just all over the country. And I know it's happening there in Minneapolis as well. I think that, you know, first time home buyers especially need to be very cautious about cutting corners with, you know, not seeing disclosures, not doing inspections, not having full understanding of what you might be getting into with that property. And that is, and unfortunately, that's the environment that we're in right now. If you really want that house, you've got to really take into consideration what that might mean in terms of longer term costs and, you know, what risks might be there behind the scenes that could be very costly to buyers later.
Susan, question here on Twitter from Jay Tonic, who says, one piece missing from the discussion is the large number of underwater homeowners who would move up with equity normally. I thought there weren't very many Americans left who were underwater in their mortgage. What's the situation?
There are still. We have in many markets, although it feels like we're booming, and we are, because once you get back to peak, you know, that's pretty impressive. Those prices at peak were high, but we're not near peak in many markets yet. We're 25% under peak in many markets, which means that those who purchased in 2006 are in many markets, if they purchased with a very high loan-to-value, which many did, they may still be underwater. That is a significant, small and decreasing over time. So we're getting out of that problem, but we're not 10 years after the boom and beginning of the bust, we're still not over that underwater problem.
Wow.
That's how long crises, the overhang can be. So we're still just coming out of that. It's a lot going on in this market.
On Twitter here, a listener says, would love to buy a home, but it's hard to save for a down payment when you have to spend over 30% of income on rent. Yeah, that makes sense. And a call here from Marcia in Annandale. Hi, Marcia. How's this working for you? Hi.
Just to go back to the previous caller's comment about buying a house, I did that before the bubble broke, and we had like 5 offers on the house. I was the highest bidder and went in with no inspection contingency. And once I was in the house, I had to make a lot of renovations and changes that I wouldn't have had to make if I would have had an inspection.
Uh-huh. So buyer beware on that. What's your situation, Marcia, right now? Are you out there looking to buy?
Well, because I lost my home to a short sale, I wasn't able to buy again because I didn't have the income. I was looking at a mobile home in the cities, but the lot rents at the home parks are $400 to $600 a month. Hmm. So you combine that with a mortgage on your mobile home, it'd be just like renting something, extremely high rents. So I ended up moving out to Annandale, got a job up here where the lot rents are lower. It's like $200 a month plus my mortgage. So therefore, it's affordable for me.
Okay.
Where in the cities, I couldn't even afford it.
Yeah. Elena, what Marcia was saying there about the short sale, I think I hear her saying unable to get a mortgage after that. I mean, that's that pristine credit lack of that you were talking about earlier, isn't it?
Definitely. I mean, the foreclosure crisis did leave many millions of people in the country who had to, for however they, you know, whether it was through modifications or unfortunately through foreclosure or having to do a short sale, you know, that has stressed a lot of people's credit scores, and that has made subsequent lending for them to look into their next home difficult. Now, there have been you know, there have been some policies put in place to really to try to help remedy some of that or try to decrease the impact of those blemishes from the crisis era. And, you know, but that is a waiting period, sometimes 3, 5, 7 years it can be before really folks that have been significantly impacted by that, you know, can get into their next home.
Susan, I wanted to ask you about affordable housing and vouchers for this. I don't know if you caught this NPR story last week, but they were talking about how Section 8 housing vouchers in some cities, they use Dallas as the example, are extremely hard to use because there's a lot of landlords who don't want to take them and now because of the demand don't have to take them. I think NPR was reporting that in Dallas, around 60% of the people who have these vouchers can't use them. What does that mean for, you know, lower income and middle class income people that need to rent?
Yeah, so that's reflective of the more general increases in rents that are making renting so difficult. You know, this is a time where we're increasing the number of renters dramatically. Since the crisis, people have 6 to 8 million more rental households, but homeowner households have not increased literally net at all. So that means that the demand for rental is exceedingly high in cities across the country. Dallas is typically, historically, been an affordable city, but even affordable cities are becoming unaffordable given the rent rises and the lack of income increases, wages and salaries. So this is a problem not just for vouchers, but of course it's very much a problem for vouchers holders, but it's also a problem for working families. Workforce housing is lacking in supply, and this, of course, is a problem for communities who want to have the firefighters and the teachers and the police and the first responders in the community. Where will they live?
Yeah, Elena. The other part of that is, what about seniors? I'm hearing from some people on Twitter who are saying, you know, retired, need a downsize, sold my house, now can't find affordable rental housing. What about that end of the age spectrum?
Yeah, and that's a growing population in the region. There is folks in the aging population, and that's a significant issue. I mean, people on, you know, whether it's, you know, fixed incomes or just limited incomes, you know, looking to maybe sell the big house and move, are having tremendous problems and finding themselves, you know, almost kind of stuck in their homes because of situations related to affordability, you know, in the markets where they live, if they want to maintain or stay in the communities that they're in. So that is just a significant issue too, particularly with the rising rent situation around and the affordable kind of housing or lack thereof.
And not only a problem in the Twin Cities. I mean, you're seeing this in a lot of markets.
Right.
Okay.
That's absolutely right.
Mallory says on Twitter, my boyfriend and I are living at his mom's after his unpaid internship. That's probably delightful. Looking to rent in Rochester, Minnesota, and lost out on two already. Another listener says, we sold in California right before the bubble burst, just sold in Minnesota last week. The atmosphere feels the same as it did, so we chose to sell at the peak. And then a question here from Al in Eden Prairie. Good morning, Al. What are you thinking about here?
Good morning. My question, I kind of got in late in the conversation, so I'm not sure if you covered it much yet. My question is solutions. I heard the gal about 10 minutes ago talk about, well, we need rent control in Minneapolis. I'm sure the landlords would love to hear that. But from what I've been seeing, you know, housing prices have been going up. Construction costs have been going up due to, I'm not exactly sure what, raw material prices aren't really going up at all. Maybe it's the labor. Land prices obviously probably are driving it. But I haven't heard any talk about solutions.
Okay.
I mean, is it going to be government subsidies for everybody to buy houses, or what's the deal?
Let's put that to Susan first. What do you think, Susan?
Solutions are difficult, but individuals have to adjust to the new reality. And more broadly, the reality needs to adjust itself. The pristine credit is beyond historical norms. We need to move the country back to safe and sound lending. not lending that's overly restrictive. There are a number of attempts at doing this, initiatives right now, but they're at the beginning stages.
So I hear you saying legislation, Susan. Is that right?
Not just legislation, but
okay.
Legislation is going to be an issue because, by the way, we still haven't reformed our housing finance system. And this is really comes down to housing finance, and that's going to be a big question. What do we do with the GSEs, and what do we do so that going forward, households who can be homeowners over the long run can access homeownership and aren't forced to pay high rents that make it difficult to save. So that is a legislative question, but there's also regulation, and there's policies that are the GSEs, Fannie, Freddie, FHA, are looking. But you know, it's not as though there are silver bullets here. They're trying new things, and it is hopeful that there will be some moves going forward on a larger scale. But in the meantime, cities and localities also are looking to local solutions, inclusionary housing, to make it easier for folks to leave their families, get jobs. But again, where the jobs are is exactly where it's difficult to get housing.
Susan,
so
I appreciate the time this morning.
Infrastructure solution as well.
I have to wrap it. Susan, thank you. Good to have your insight on this. And Elena, thank you very much for being part of the conversation.
Carrie, thank you for having us.